Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
We made this. Welcome back, everybody, to the Movie Palace. I'm your host, as ever, Carl Sweeney, and thank you very much for joining me for this week's episode. I'll introduce what we're going to talk about today in a moment, but let me just bring my guests on today first this time. So, two people with me today, long-time friends of the podcast, I suppose, Clara Cook and Kelechi Ihenyolo. So, hi, guys. Hi, Clara. Hi, Kelechi.
Hey, Carl.
Hey.
How are you both doing? I hope you've had... It's been a while, isn't it? Because we... I think the last time we were together on a podcast was All About Eve, which was probably last summer. I think, Clara, you and I maybe podcasted about Johnny Guitar with Gabriella more recently than that. But yeah, it's been a while. So I hope you're both keeping well. Hope you've had a nice non-dramatic 2020 so far.
I think that's a very loaded question there, Carl.
I'm sorry.
But yeah, I mean, on a guess, on a personal front, I've done okay. You know, family's safe. You know, lockdown has been very interesting, You know, in terms of, you know, keeping safe and obviously we're still in the midst of a global pandemic and obviously, other issues that have come to light, obviously with, George Floyd and so forth. So that's been very prominent on my mind as of late. So, you know, there's a lot of things that, that needs to be reflected on, and I hope going forward, when we come out of lockdown properly, not the kind of what the government's doing, but we recognize those things that we've gone through and, you know, find a better solution for a lot of things, because I think the sense of normality has gone out the window and it needs to be done. It needs to be dismantled at all costs.
Yeah, well, we'll be able to reflect on some of those things today, I think. Clara, how about you? How are you doing?
I mean, it's been a bit of a, strange period. I think that for many people, like, the idea of returning back to normal life seems like something they are really keen on doing. However, I don't think things are going to return to normal like they were before. I would include that. I would include that statement for pretty much anybody who is a listener of this podcast and is interested in film. I suspect that watching films in the same way that we used to is probably not going to be the same. We're not going to have that anymore, I don't think. It's not going to be the same case. For me personally, I've been working this entire time back home, which has been a learning curve because I never really did that before. And Turns out that job they said that you couldn't do from home, you can totally do from home. and I don't think I'll be leaving lockdown or at least not really changing my habits much for probably many, many months to come. So watching the world reopen and not really being part of it is definitely going to be something I think that's going to be psychologically hard, I think.
Yeah. So just to kind of clarify what we're going to talk about today, because when the podcast returned earlier this year, it was when the lockdown period had started. And the first episode back was all about... life in the age of lockdown, but that was a few months ago now. Of course, this is going to be a lengthy process, so I thought it'd be good to talk about some of these things now, not least because we're now at a stage in our country and in others where things like cinemas are planning to reopen. In some countries, they have reopened. Also to do with some of the issues I think are relevant here that Kelechi alluded to there about the protests and the Black Lives Matter movement and so on. Because the issue of Gone with the Wind and HBO Max taking that down has happened as well. We can maybe touch on some of these things. So yeah, I thought we could, instead of talking about a particular film this week, maybe just chew over some of these current topics. And of course, this is an episode that will obviously age quite quickly. But so it'll hopefully serve as a bit of a time capsule. We're here on the 28th of June, 2020. Hopefully the episode will be out not too long after. Hopefully it'll be a bit of a time capsule about what sorts of things people are talking about and thinking about in mid-2020. So, okay, we're recording not long before cinemas in the UK plan to start reopening. I think Cineworld is planning to reopen from July the 10th. I think Odeon is doing like a staggered reopening from the starting from July the 4th, I think. But I was just kind of wondering how, you know, we're all keen cinema goers. We know each other through podcasting, but we've met up a couple of times to go to the cinema, for instance. How do we feel as keen cinema goers about the potential for cinemas to reopen? And you can answer this on like a personal front or as an abstract point, I guess. Kelechi, how about you?
For me personally, you know, I miss the cinemas like anybody. You know, I'm to kind of use a very popular science fiction analogy, you know, the idea of, you know, going into the cinema, finding your screening room is like stepping into another dimension. And behind that door is a story to be told. So that excitement, that enthusiasm, that kind of buzz that I always get from being in the cinema, also the social aspect as well. You know, whether you're with your friends or whether you're going by the cinema by yourself and, you know, you're reacting to the same things on the screen. You are, you know, engrossed in whatever storyline that is being told, or you're kind of reacting into, oh my God, this film is so dumb. but it's those kind of emotional highs and emotional lows that you get that is, you can't, in some ways you can't get that in the home. And, you know, it's those kind of little things, especially being in lockdown, you realize those little things that you miss the most. But having said that, because we're still in a global pandemic, you know, if you look at the stories from America, mm-hmm. where they're just receiving huge spikes every single day, film releases have been constantly pushed back for good reasons. But at the same time, the cinema's reopening now not only feels not only too soon to be a reopening, but also feels more based on a commercial decision rather than a health and safety decisions. And even though they're taking the various amount of precautions, it's still no guarantees. If I read a report the other day where face masks are kind of up to whether you as a customer or the staff. And it's not saying, look, we need you to have face masks and be actually the front and corner of that health and safety, because it's not just necessarily me that is trying to not get COVID for obvious reasons and everybody else, but it's also protecting the staff and the people who work in those industries, the people who are going to be on the ground level managing the whole influx of customers that are probably going to be that they're going to be serving. So there's this kind of weird response to it that's neither helpful or satisfying to make it for me to convince me to say, yes, you know what, I'm going to go back to the cinema. Especially, you know, where, you know, our health service is vulnerable. And, you know, coming from also personal experience as well, where some of my friends during lockdown came down with COVID and their families were infected with COVID. And, you know, speaking with them during that time where, you know, they had difficulties with breathing and difficulties with, you know, trying to stay sane and positive, even though, you know, when you're dealing with a high death toll rate, and they're praying that they're not going to be part of that statistic. And I'm trying to say, look, you know, it's not going to go down that way. But that's a scary time for a lot of people. So for me, I want to do my part as in, look, I will maintain lockdown, I'll maintain whatever kind of social distancing that I can. But, you know, considering how many, you know, confusing messages that are, you know, from the government has come from, even maintaining social distancing seems like it's non-apparent and no one's really respecting it. So it's kind of like, if we're not respecting it in, you know, when we're just going out to the shops, if we're going just down the road for a walk or just for a little bit of exercise, how is it in a public space that we're going to maintain those kind of social distancing? And even though they got social distancing champions, quote unquote, you know, it's still a lot of toll and stress, you know, and we are coming out of a lockdown period where people's mental health will probably be tested. A lot of social anxieties will probably be, you know, will have to be adjusted. So the idea of going back to normal doesn't feel correct in that respect. And in terms of, you know, the film selections, they're fun, you know, I think it was over 400 films were made available by the distributors in terms of selections, which is fantastic in terms of the broad range, in terms of, you know, the diversity as well, and LGBTQ, if I spelled that right, LGBTQ selections as well. But it's also showing that there's still a long way to go in terms of what actually films got picked up for the main cinemas. So if you're looking at Odeon and the Cineworlds of this world, you know, it's still the popular films, obviously popular for a reason, because they are our comfort films to go to. They're the ones who make us, the films that make us happy, that they're euphoric, and in many ways forget about the troubles and toils that we've experienced in our world. But it's also, you know, films that have not carried through in terms of diversity and representation. I think it's only the Genesis Cinema that is saying that from when we reopen, we're showing Queen and Slim. So it's still a long way to go in terms of how we're changing the narrative in terms of diversity and how it's reflected in the cinema, and how we continue that conversation of representation, and also on the grander scheme of, you know, with COVID, ensuring that health and safety measures are adhered to, and we're not just protecting ourselves, but we're protecting the people who are on the front line, who are going to be at the front and center of that.
I mean, there's lots of stuff we can break down there, but I mean, I've missed cinemas a lot. I think the last films I saw, I went 3 times in consecutive days between I looked it up, February the 29th to March the 2nd. I saw A Portrait of a Lady on Fire, Dark Waters, and then The Invisible Man. And from what I can recall, I was already feeling at that point that this might not be possible for much longer. It wasn't actually until March the 23rd that the UK-wide lockdown was introduced. Too late, in my view. Now, as much as I've missed going to the cinema, I won't be first in line, definitely, on the day they reopen. I feel like cinemas are the type of venue, and I'll confess I'm not an expert on this by any means, but they feel like the types of venues where contagious viruses can spread effectively. I think the rate of transmission in this country, as we record at the end of June, is too high to make that a risk worth taking, you know. So I'd dearly love to get to a situation where I don't feel that way, but that's kind of where I am at the moment. Clara, what are your thoughts on this issue?
So, I mean, I think both of you have quite adequately covered, like, the health and safety risk, and I totally agree. I think that health and safety wise, it's too early to reopen the cinemas. I think also there's the element of the toilets. One of the things that I saw some of the chief medical officers say is that you have to, like, disinfect a toilet between each person using it. I just don't see how they can do that in a public space. So, you know, you're quite likely to catch it from using a toilet than you are, you know, from sitting next to somebody in the cinema who's got it. So the thoughts that I have about this are also, so aside from the health and safety, which is the first most important thing, obviously, that we should be thinking about, is that it's also about behaviour. It's about what people are willing to do. And I don't know, I just don't think people are willing to go sit in a cinema 2 meters apart from each other and wear a mask the entire time to watch a film. That's just not enjoyable. I don't know if either of you want a mask for any length of time, but it's not a pleasurable experience. And sitting in a room full of people wearing masks, you don't get that sort of collective cinema experience that you normally get with an audience. It's quite isolating, you can't tell what anybody's expressions are, it's anonymous and kind of unpleasant, but also breathing into a mask, it's just not a pleasant experience. So I think people, if they're forced to do that in a cinema, are not going to wear a mask and not be healthy and safe, or they're just going to be like, I don't want to do that, and so they're going to stay home and watch a film on Netflix. The other thing is that a lot of people in this period have been furloughed, and a considerable number of people have been made redundant. So they're not going to have a huge amount of money to go into central London and spend it at the Odeon Cinema, which is a pricey cinema, right? So the big cinemas are going to open first because they have the most space.
Yeah.
They probably have more staff to do health and safety measures, all that kind of thing. They also are going to pay a big price because they, you know, they charge a lot. They need a lot to cover their costs if they don't open. But I wonder if the first thing people are going to do is go to a very expensive cinema in central London. I mean, we're talking about a situation where people haven't seen their family for months. I kind of think that a lot of people are going to hop in the car as soon as they can and drive to see their relatives over going into central London to see a blockbuster on the screen. The other aspect of this is that it's about the resources that you have at home as well. And now that a lot of people, like before I moved into my new home, at the end of last year, I hadn't had a TV for 10 years. And then we bought a TV, and I'll tell you very honestly, I'm never going back. I can't believe I watched everything on a laptop screen for 10 years. Like, what was I thinking? Yeah. So now that I have a TV at home, it's not huge. It's not bigger than anybody else's, like 42 inch or something, right? Which is big for me, but not massively big compared to when we went to buy it. The salesman was like, you know, you can get something that is like the size of your wall, right? And we were like, we don't want that. Yeah. But you know, now that people have big TV screens, they can watch cinematic films, you know, with beautiful scenery or whatever, action, whatever they want, on big screens at home. So, and it's also the cost of it as well. Like, people can rent a film on Amazon now for £3 or £4, as opposed to going to the cinema and paying, you know, I don't know, £20 or whatever, which, because some cinemas are very expensive, to get in and watch a film. Now, I understand that the cinema experience is something you can't replicate at home. But if I were the cinemas, I'll be honest, it's the same with the theatres, it's the same with orchestras and concert halls. It's going to be a long time before they start making the money that they were making in previous years. I mean, especially big arts venues. I mean, just my workplace alone, I won't go into telling you exactly how much we're going to lose because I'm pretty sure that's confidential. But over the next 2 years, we're going to be losing millions, millions and millions and millions of pounds. And I work for a university. Yeah. I think that arts institutions are going to be closing left and right. So they're not going to make it back anytime soon. So, and they're not going to be able to fill that hole that they've got from 2020. So if I were them, what I'd start doing is trying to produce as much at-home content as possible. Now, the issue with that is people feel differently about paying for a film at home than they do about paying for a film in the cinema. So people might be willing to pay, you know, £15 to £20 to go see a film in the cinema. It's an experience. You go with your friends, you go with your family, you get that popcorn, blah, blah, blah. Whereas they won't want to pay £15 or £20 to Amazon or to rent a film or to some other streaming service. And you kind of saw that from the Emma, the most recent Emma film, I think, was out to rent because it had literally just come out in the cinema, so they couldn't put up for sale. It was out to rent on Amazon for about, I don't know, it was something like £14 or £15. And I saw people on social media saying, I'm not going to pay £14, £15 to rent this film. And that kind of, you know, said to me, well, actually, people aren't willing to pay cinema prices at home to see a film. But, you know, everybody wants that new James Bond film. You know, everyone's keen to see it. I wonder if the distributors just released it online and said one-off payment of £12, £14, £15 and you can see it, you can watch it. I wonder if people across the UK wouldn't pay it. Like, I just wonder if they wouldn't. And maybe they wouldn't pay for everything. Probably some of the more smaller art house films, actually, probably, to be honest, Kelechi, the films that you're talking about that have more diversity in them, maybe they wouldn't do as well because people aren't willing to pay as much big bucks as they are for the big blockbusters.
Yeah.
But if I were a cinema right now, I'd start thinking long term about how I'm going to engage audiences in their own homes, because we're going to get a second wave. Different areas are going to lock down. Even if London, you know, doesn't lock down completely, it's likely another city will. Leicester. They're talking about locking down Leicester right now. Like, all the cinemas in Leicester, like, that's another period where they can't have anybody going there. So, I mean, not that I'm, like, an expert. I'm like, I've got the answer, guys. I've got the answer to it all. But I feel that if I was an arts venue or a cinema or a theatre, I'd start thinking really, really, like, out of the box. Thinking, I'm not going to have a full audience probably until 2022, if not longer.
That's true. I mean, just to add on with Clara, you know, going back to the diversity, absolutely. You know, that's why they go for the popular choices. It's probably not the time to experiment, quote unquote, with those kind of with diversity films. But, you know, I like to see an option at least, you know, at least try, because I rather see it then rather than like, you know, yeah, we're just going to go and show Toy Story and show Batman Begins and so forth. I'd rather just let, at least put it out there, just show it and see what happens. Because if we're not doing that as an experimentation, then what is the point? And also, you know, absolutely with cost, I mean, it's not going to be a new normal anymore. We're not going back to the normal that we had before. For cinemas to make money, you have to operate with like a 60% capacity. So that means they probably would have to end up, you know, we're showing practically maybe the same films on different screens. They can't have that many selections. They're already going to be operating at half the capacity. So it's now much more difficult for them to make more money than they were before. So, you know, in my heart of hearts, I didn't expect cinemas to be reopening until next year. You know, I didn't expect, if the theater companies have all said, we're not going to be reopening until next year. And that's because of the operating loss. So the fact that they are, you know, doing petitions and campaigns to kind of save our theaters, save our landscape. That shows you the level of severity that we're in. So then the fact that the cinemas are pushing for the reopening, like I said, is more to do with commercial to kind of get back into the swing of things. But it's not going to be the same. And it's going to be a while before we see some kind of, by their standards, a normality. And these films that are being released are, you would arguably be just there testing the waters. And hence why you're now seeing, you know, more, I guess, experimental choices, as in we're now seeing a revitalization of drive-ins, which, you know, I've never been to one. I would certainly love to go and try and experience that out as an option. But if we're not moving any of the new releases to have an option to kind of have drive-ins experience, then it's just a novelty rather than actually, okay, we're trying to expand and try and think out the box. Okay, we'll show Mulan in a drive-in near you, wherever you can go. And again, it comes down to affordability, as Clara said. I've seen some drive-in cinemas that are charging 50 quid per car for just to be there. And I'm just like, well, that's twice as more than you would pay for a cinema ticket. And that's three times more than you would pay online if you had the option to watch it online. So there's no rules to this. I don't have the answers. Carl's don't have the answers. I'm sure, Carl, you don't have the answer either. But we do need to rethink about how we look at the cinematic model. We have to rethink about, you know, how in these circumstances we have relied on streaming services to actually keep us sane in this time. And, you know, at one point the cinemas were trying to boycott Universal titles at one point because Trolls 2 was doing phenomenally well online, which is, if you told me in 2020 that was a film that was going to break the cinema industry, I would have told you were lying. But here we are. But Trolls 2 did magnificently well because in lockdown conditions with nothing to do, if you've got families, then you're more inclined to buy a family-oriented film that you can repeat now and again so your kids can get entertained. But it's not going to be the same for every other film that's there. So it's a new normal. It's a new thing that there's still going to be loads of questions to. But as Clara said, that we have to think out more outside of that box in terms of how we engage with our audiences.
Yeah, it's funny because I saw somebody tweeting about Trolls. They'd done like a tweet where they were going through like the landmarks in the history of cinema. It was like 1927, the jazz singer, you know, talking films. It went through the eras. 2020, Trolls World Tour, because it's signaling possibly a paradigm like shift. Isn't this about survival though? Because I think if cinemas stay closed, surely it's only a matter of time until they start to go bust, you know. And I think that if they reopen and people stay away, it's probably still only a matter of time until they go bust. And I think we could say similar things about, you know, pubs, restaurants, for example, which in this country haven't reopened yet. I know it's different in different places. Obviously, you've got this basic quandary, which we're kind of talking about. Unless they can be opened in a way that doesn't further the spread of the virus, it's a real public health issue. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, and this kind of factors into what they're showing. So obviously, all the big films are being pushed back until hopefully a time when more people will be able to go and see them. So we've had things like Mulan and Tenet kind of push back multiple times, I think. So they've put together this list of 450 titles in this country, new and classic films for viewers. So you've already talked a bit about this, but it's older stuff like Singing in the Rain is on the list, for example, through to like the Harry Potter films, Twilight, Back to the Future, and then films that are more recent that were released before lockdown. I think Emma, you mentioned, is on the list. It's going to go back potentially to cinemas. I think it's very interesting. I wonder what will happen, and I'm quite cynical, I'm afraid. I think that the pandemic has kind of exacerbated inequality. And I think that in the film sense, what will happen is that when they get back open, I think the big films will come out. There'll be fewer screens showing films, potentially less people coming in. And I think the big films will monopolize the attention and the smaller films will get kind of pushed to one side. So, yeah, I'm afraid. Is that too pessimistic, Clara?
No, I agree with you. I think that when times are tough economically, people fall back on what they know, what they're used to. I would say the status quo isn't necessarily the thing that is the best. It's just something that they have used to, and they kind of it's familiar to them. And I think, like, from what a lot of what Kelechi is saying is very true. I think diversity in film and in television, diversity on screen, is a lot about exposing people to something they're not used to, or something they're not used to seeing. And I think that requires a level of imagination and investment from the audience or from the viewer that perhaps maybe they may not be willing to give, or actually not necessarily they may not be willing to give, but that cinema film distributors don't think they're willing to watch. I'm actually not sure it's that the audience doesn't want this. I think the audience actually is more interested in diversity on screen than film production companies and distributors actually think they are. That's just my opinion, but I could be wrong, but I don't think I am. And I think that that's one of the reasons why let's show Singing in the Rain. Singing in the Rain is a classic. Everyone loves it. It's nice to see on the big screen. I'd love to see Singing in the Rain on the big screen, but I also can watch it at home.
Yeah.
And that's another sort of, that's a little bit of a risk there. It's a gamble, because a lot of these films you can see at home. And I think one of the things I would say is that, and I'm sure we'll go on to talk about this, is that right now, so there's two things. One, the Harry Potter films didn't come out that long ago. Do you know what I mean? So Emma didn't come out that long ago. I reckon everyone who wanted to see Emma would have seen it before the lockdown happened, at least most people, right? So I think you're going to get a relatively small number of people going to see Emma in the cinema, I'll be honest with you. So a lot of these films as well, also films that didn't come out too long ago, I guess they had high numbers of people seeing them before. Maybe that's one of the reasons why they made a decision. But I would be interested to see why they haven't done many more sort of films from the past, because there are films from the past that like are perhaps maybe have a cult following now, but aren't necessarily big then. And not films that came out so like in the like living memory, like Harry Potter and stuff. But I mean, right now when we're having this like a sort of popular culture or like public discourse about, you know, are some of these films still okay to watch? Are they still appropriate? You know, like you mentioned Gone with the Wind and stuff like that. I wonder if it's not such a good idea to start releasing old films in the cinema. Like, as far as I know, I don't really know any sort of problematic connotations with Singing in the Rain, although I could be completely wrong about that. But I wonder, when they're selecting this 450 list of films, did they think about that? Do they think, well, actually, you know, like Gone with the Wind is now, you know, now people are thinking very seriously about like the sort of the problematic issues with Gone with the Wind, although they were there before.
It was controversial at the time,
talking about it. Yeah. So now I'm wondering, is any of those 450 films going to fall into that category? You know, like, is it wise to start doing this? Start releasing films without thinking about it?
I can tell you that one of the films on the list is Breakfast at Tiffany's. And I don't know if you've seen that film. If you remember Mickey Rooney's portrayal of the Japanese neighbor, I think that very much is problematic. And it's whether, like, just being on the list is one thing, but it's whether then they actually select, let's say Emma might not actually be shown. It might just be on the list and then the cinemas don't pick it up. I don't know. And there's lots to come on to here. I just wanted to talk a bit quickly about what actually visiting a cinema will be like. And I think we kind of alluded to this already, but the guidelines are out now, the guidance from the UK Cinema Association, which was in consultation with the government's Department for Culture, Media and Sport. Again, might well differ in the US or other places, but it sounds quite striking to me. So I'll just run through this as quickly as I can, but it's kind of interesting. So they suggest using outside premises such as car parks for queuing, obviously the use of hand sanitizer as people enter, floor markings inside to highlight social distancing, protective screens between staff and customers, self-service stuff like the pick and mix stand should be removed, but obviously they can still serve popcorn. Allocated seating to meet social distancing measures, and staff should be appointed as, I think you mentioned this term already, Kalechi, social distancing champions, which is an interesting one. One-way traffic, so you go in one way, you come out the other. Managed occupancy levels could be limited to around 60% capacity. Frequent cleaning between each screening, reducing the number of showings. Restaurants and cafes closed. And face coverings is the interesting one, I think, because they're required on public transport now in this country, in England, since June 15th. But their use in cinemas will neither be expected or encouraged. But staff and customers who do wish to wear them, or something similar, will not be discouraged from doing so. So I don't know. I think it raises a really interesting question about what we're actually going to the cinema for, doesn't it? Because I think instinctively we say, oh, we're going to watch the film. But in reality, I think that cinema going was always kind of a pleasurable experience on like a spatial level as well, wasn't it? Like, it's a comfortable place. It's luxurious. You have these little rituals, like you line up, you exchange your money for a ticket, you walk a short distance, your ticket, they let you go in because you got the ticket. You move towards the big screen. And like you kind of mentioned, Kalechi, you enter another world, you know, through the narrative of the film. So I think in the past, all that kind of happened quite ideally. It happened quite smoothly and seamlessly, doesn't it? But that's not what's going to happen here, it sounds like, because the kinds of measures we're talking about there, they're obviously necessary, and perhaps they should be stronger. At the same time, it's going to really change that experience, isn't it? And I'm not sure how much fun that's going to be. Does that make sense, Kalechi?
It does. And also, as Clara says, I mean, there's even more chances of contamination. Yeah. I mean, I did read a report that came out during lockdown, and it was talking about if cinemas were to reopen, some of those measures that you've just mentioned would be on the list. But it also strictly prohibited of selling food and snacks and popcorn and so forth, because the fact that you're interacting with customers and serving food also has potential of spreading contamination as well. And for a lot of cinemas, that is definitely not practical, because if they're not making money off the ticket sales, I think a percentage of that will go to the Hollywood studios. Yeah. And then I think it's like the second or the third week, the money starts to roll in for the cinemas themselves. So there's always like this weird kind of distribution cut deal that they do. So realistically, are they going to make that money to kind of go to have the cinemas open, to keep the building open, to pay for, you know, running costs and all that kind of stuff at 60% of capacity? It doesn't seem like that's going to be a viable option. And for a lot of cinemas, I'm thinking of like the big massive chain cinemas, like the massive multiplexes, like the one I know that is in like the Cineworld in Enfield, for example, where they do have a car park space, and yes, they do, logistically I can see them, yes, implementing that every single, line in those guidelines. But what about the smaller outlets where there is no car parks, where there is no, you know, the natural exit to get out? It'll definitely be a fire exit, but you know, it's you'll probably be led into a street alley somewhere around the corner, you know. But I don't know whether how all the cinemas will accommodate to all of those rulings. It might not even be logistically possible for them to comply with everything. So it's a lot of pressure on the cinemas to kind of adhere to all of them. But at the same time, it's going to be interesting to see how it implements. But like I said, I probably won't be the first one in line to experience that. It'll take me a while before I gain the confidence to go back to the cinema. Hopefully by the time, you know, next year we'll have a vaccine in place for that to be, guaranteed 100% sure. But like, yeah, this year I've completely cinemas, I'm not looking to go back until 2021, to be honest. And it's just, for me, it's going to be fascinating to see how those logistics are going to be carried out, because I don't think it's going to be as smoothly and as perfect. And as Clara mentioned, if you've got, people's behavior if they're not gonna, you know, if they're not, cinema etiquette was always on the as an issue beforehand, before lockdown and before COVID, in terms of people looking at their phones and you know, talking in the screening. Might even be worse when it's in a sort of strange circumstances where, okay, some people may have face masks, some people might not. Some people are chewing on popcorn and maybe coughing into it or whatever, and then you're in a circulated room where any kind of thing can be spread. So it just depends on what the cinemas can do financially to kind of make sure that they adhere to it. And in many cases, they probably won't. And hence why for many independent cinemas, because they're not, I have not seen them reopen. You know, it's mainly the chain cinemas that have that are planning to reopen. So it means that for the independent cinemas, they do not have those resources in place to kind of start doing those measures until it is for them logically safe for them to do it.
Yeah, I think I always think of the scene in Jaws. I don't know if you remember where the mayor is like telling everybody on the beach to get in the water. And like, there's a bit of reluctance. I think I'll be one of those people who stays on the sand as long as I can. To be honest. I don't know. It's very interesting. Like Clara, I think, first of all, like the social distancing champions, I'm worried about that because I think cinema staff have a lot to do already. And a lot of the cinemas I go to, they don't rigorously enforce things like people sitting in the right space, like where their ticket says they should be and stuff like that. So I hope it's properly done. It just doesn't sound like much fun, does it? Going to a cinema with all those measures we talked about. Like I say, it's necessary, but it's quantifiably a different thing, isn't it?
Yes. And I mean, I would say if we all have to wear masks on public transport because it's an enclosed space, what's the difference between a tube train and a cinema? Like, I mean, I mean, I guess maybe a screen room would be slightly bigger than a tube train, but not a huge amount. I mean, if you have to wear masks on a bus, you should wear masks in a cinema. Like, it's you're still in an enclosed space, and the distances as well. Like, it's not just about the distances of people sitting in a screen room, it's about the distances of getting into the screen. So, you know, if you've got to stay 2 meters, 1 meter apart, 1.5 meters, I mean, let's be honest, the British public doesn't know what 1.5 meters are. I mean, the average person cannot by eye tell 1.5 meters are, and it's probably quite likely that cinema staff can't either, and who can blame them, you know? So no one's going to be like keeping that the right amount of distance from each other. And you know, the virus doesn't know if it's 1.5 or 1.98 or 2.3. I mean, it doesn't really, you know, I mean, it could be anything, it could be arbitrary. It's like you're seeing six people, you might as well be seeing 10 people. I mean, the sort of instructions given to businesses and to individuals are so complex and bizarre and weird now and confusing that you're just going to have people doing whatever they want, which means the virus will spread.
Or trying to do the right thing, but not, like you say, being confused and thus not doing the right thing.
Yeah. I mean, I think the majority of the population probably are trying to do the right thing. And I'll get onto the psychology of the population in a minute, because I think as well, like, I think that's something we should probably discuss. But the issues, I mean, one of the things that we face in my workplace is it isn't just simply, you know, whether or not we can fit, how many students we can fit in a lecture theatre, is how do we get those students into a lecture theatre while still maintaining a metre or 2 metres distance from each other? You know, so some of the corridors in our buildings are so narrow that you can't pass somebody with enough distance. You can't pass people within a metre, you know, like in a corridor. So it's about that as well. Like, can you go into the toilet in a cinema and still maintain a metre's distance while washing your hands in the toilet? I mean, you could get down to all these little nitty gritty details, and then sort of the plan of being safe in a cinema sort of starts to fall apart. I think that the staff as well, there's a lot of pressure placed on staff, like you were saying. It's not going to be... I mean, I went and visited HSBC to deposit a check at one point in the last couple of months, and it was a very highly socially distanced experience. There's a lot of safety measures in place. But one of the things that was really apparent, and the lovely staff who were very clear about where we needed to go and what we could do and couldn't do, and it was, you know, well, really well done. But one of the things that was highly obvious was how stressed the staff were. This is day in, day out. Staff are going to be going to cinemas trying to instill some sort of health and safety for something that they probably aren't very adequately trained to do. And why should they be? You know, I mean, the cinema staff, they're not, you know, health and safety experts. You know, maybe they will have done some sort of risk assessment, maybe not. And, you know, and they'll be trying to instill these measures, and dealing with members of the public is difficult as it is. In this context, it's going to be even harder. I just think the toll it's going to take on staff in the arts sector and in the cinema industry is you're just going to be exhausted at the end of every day. And you're also going to be putting yourself at risk as well. And the other thing I would say about the psychology of the population is I read that it takes about 10 weeks for human beings to get used to a really huge change, right? So that, and I would say lockdown and the way that our world has changed is a massive change for for pretty much everybody, with the exception of maybe people who were housebound before, you know, so it's massive. And so it's going to take probably 10 weeks for everyone to get used to coming out of lockdown. The government wants us to all kind of start living life again, going out, buying, you know, the Saturday where they have all these things changing. They're going to call it Super Saturday, which I just think is really ridiculous. Super virus spreading Saturday. You know, I mean, this isn't the Olympics. This isn't, we're not going to win gold medals on this Saturday. Trust me, there's going to be no gold medals for anybody. So, you know, the idea that we're all supposed to suddenly go back into the world.
Yeah.
And it's just psychologically, even without the threat of catching a virus, right, which seems to affect different people randomly in different ways. Some people get very ill, some people don't get really ill at all. Just aside from all of that, it's just difficult to make a sudden change like that. I think the population, they've been in lockdown, so a lot of them will want to go out and, you know, be free. But I don't know if all of them are going to rush to go to the cinema, because I feel like that's not the same as going and sitting in the park with, you know, relatives that you've been missing for the last 4 or 5 months. So, yeah, it takes time for human behavior to change. And so I think the cinemas are going to pay the price for that.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because I'd like some alone time. So I'd quite like to go to the cinema, to be fair. So it's interesting, yeah.
Okay, so yeah, so maybe this is where we segue to talking a bit more about some of this home viewing stuff that we've kind of got into already, you know, because that's the interesting thing is, like, despite loving going to the cinema and all that, not being able to go, it hasn't hit me as hard as it's hit some of my friends who, like, love football, for instance, who had nothing like that. Let's say friends who all they do is watch football, talk about football, you know, follow the rumours, the news, and then they had nothing to do for months. It hit them really hard, and I think the thing is that I found the lockdown tough in various ways, but I've still been able to indulge my interest in film easily enough. DVDs, Blu-rays, Netflix, all the rest of it. So I haven't been kind of bereft. So how has the pandemic affected our own viewing habits? I mean, I'll say that because my daughter's been home from preschool, you know, for months now, hasn't interacted with any children, really. I've been spending a lot of time with her. I've been watching a lot of cartoons, and I'm fed up with it. I mean, so much Scooby-Doo over the past few months, and more than enough, honestly. More positively, we've been having like film nights twice a week with our 12-year-old son, and he's quite a moody guy, but I think we've all been enjoying that as kind of a little routine. It's tricky. He's a tricky age because he's aware of a lot of things that he shouldn't be watching, but he wants to, and he thinks he's too old for a lot of the things that he is allowed to see. So it's a different balancing habit. I don't know, Kletchy, have you watched, like, have your viewing habits changed because of all this? Are you, yeah, how have you coped with it?
Well, for someone who had a part-time job working in a cinema, so a lot of the stuff that Clara was talking about in terms of the mental health stress certainly was on the forefront. And because now, you know, I have so much time on my hands, literally, in terms of viewing habits, you know, I after thanks to my brother who bought Disney Plus, so I was able to hitch on his account and watch things that I haven't been able to watch previously. Because, you know, if you're working as I was when I did had a full-time paying job, and, you know, transitioning into a film critic and so forth, you know, making the time to go and watch things, you know, you're dealing with a very hectic life, let's be honest. So you've got so many different commitments, so many different responsibilities, and you can never really make time for this. If there's an upside to lockdown, even though, you know, I miss my family, I live on my own, you know, talking to them through Zoom or on the phone has been my source of contact, but, you know, but in reality, I'm desperate for a hug from them. Especially as my niece celebrated her 4th birthday the other day. So it was like, it really hit me hard. At the same time, you know, I've been able to watch films and content that, you know, I've never been able to get to watch. And, you know, something like on Disney Plus, like, you know, I'm a massive Star Wars fan, so being able to binge my way through the whole entirety of the Clone Wars, for example, especially as I timed it perfectly with the whole Star Wars Day and Disney Plus releasing the very last episode on Star Wars Day as well. So it felt really like, for me, that felt like an achievement. And I'm sure, and I've had conversations with Clara because we're going to be doing a podcast on that soon. So make sure you book that, Clara. You know, but it's also an opportunity for me to, you know, I've, as much as some of the new releases have been, on, you know, released to digitally, you know, the conversation that Clara was mentioning about paying, you know, £15 to rent a new release, you know, considering that my financial situation wasn't the greatest at the early points of lockdown, I was like, you know what, I'm not going to do that. I think the only one I did was The Invisible Man, which starred Elizabeth yeah. Moss, which was, if you need a film recommendation, it is fantastic. So, you know, that was, you know, that became like, okay, that was sort of a stopgap in the fill. But I also, because of lockdown, I'm trying to sort of look at films that have been on either on my wish list or just never had the opportunity to watch. So, you know, BBC releasing the RKO content on their service and able to watch things like Citizen Kane, which I have seen before, mm-hmm. but wanted to watch again because I wanted to kind of, you know, I felt like I was in the right space and mind to watch it properly and analyze it. You know, The Magnificent Ambersons, Bringing Up Baby. What's the other one I watched? Top Hat, which was, I think, the last one I watched as well. So it was for me, you know, as a film critic, where, you know, I'm always trying to, you know, take in as much films as I can, but at the same time, always trying to expand my knowledge. And I just used some of the downtime period to actually just go and look at some of those older classics and films that have always eluded me, but there was never, you know, opportunity to kind of sit down and watch them all. Mm-hmm. And in the space of a week, I was able to get through some of those RKO classics on BBC iPlayer and look at content, you know, with a fresh pair of eyes, I guess.
Yeah, I wanted to mention those RKO films that have gone up on iPlayer. So yeah, only relevant really to people in the UK, I guess. Mm-hmm. But 23 films, including like the ones you mentioned, like Citizen Kane, King Kong, Top Hat, She Wore a Yellow Ribbon. I'll confess, yeah, I'm quite happy that my license fee money has gone towards making these films more widely available. I've watched a few of them. I watched Kitty Foyle, which is the film that Ginger Rogers won her Oscar for. And I watched Wagon Master, which is a John Ford Western. So yeah, I definitely encourage people in the UK to have a look and see what kind of piques their interest there. I think for me, the thing is that I was already quite happy with using a range of different services like iPlayer, like Mubi, recording stuff off Film4 and TCM, Amazon Prime, Netflix as well. I imagine one of the interesting things, Clara, is I imagine there are probably a lot of people, maybe, let's say possibly from older generations, but not exclusively, but in a lot of cases, they might not have been as adept with things like streaming services before lockdown, and now they may have started using them. So that's kind of an interesting idea, isn't it? The idea that the pandemic might have accelerated some of these trends, they're obviously in motion anyway.
Yeah, I think there's a big part of the population that had to suddenly get used to using stuff like Zoom, you know, to actually engaging with Netflix. I mean, funnily enough that we talk about, you know, streaming services, like, so my father and mother have been watching Netflix for a few years now, but they're using my account. Like, I'll admit, like, you're allowed to have several people on the same account. Netflix isn't gonna come down on me for saying this, but which is, you know, so it's funny, it's that like I think the other day one of the passwords, I changed the password or something, and my father sort of texted me kind of like, you know, like a little sort of exasperated, like, what's happened with the password? I'm like, you know, you do know I pay for this, right, Dad? Like, I know that, you know, you've supported me and helped me and raised me, but like, this is my account, right? If I choose to change the password. But no, it's fine. He can still watch it. But, you know, so they are starting to, like, I think there are parts of the population that perhaps maybe didn't engage with this sort of stuff before, and now they are. I would question, though, I don't know the statistics, but I wonder how many older members of our society actually went to the cinema on a regular basis anyway. So I know my parents go to the cinema, and they used to go fairly a lot, but they were never really going to see any of the big blockbusters. Like, they're much more like sort of art house fans, and they'd go see something, or they'd go see a film that's sort of aimed at their age group. I think maybe people were watching terrestrial television a lot more. So yes, it, perhaps not maybe going to the cinema, perhaps maybe not streaming films. And now, you know, maybe that's something that people are doing a lot more who are older or less technologically, I don't want to say advanced because that's a bit insulting, less technologically experienced.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that the BBC made a good decision in releasing films that have not been seen on television for a long time. I think that that is something that I know my family have always, and me, include me in this, have all felt was a shame that in recent years, black and white films, older films, classic Hollywood films have not been shown on television as much. And, you know, it used to be that on Channel 4, right, on a Saturday or a Sunday, I can't remember which day now, I think it was probably a Sunday, you'd get, you know, an old film in the afternoon, old black and white film in the afternoon. And TCM used to show a lot of these older films, and now TCM's showing much more, not recent, but...
They do in this country, don't they? They show a lot of the stuff like Goodfellas that doesn't really seem as part of their remit, almost.
Yeah, I mean, I guess they could be considered retro now, but, you know, they're still within living memory of a lot of the people who...
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I'm not sure how retro Goodfellas is to my parents compared to them. You know, it might be some kind of retro to me, but... So I think that's a bit of a shame. So it's nice that during the lockdown they've done that. And I think, actually... The BBC have hit the nail right on the head with the idea of releasing something that's nostalgic. I think when you're going through a period which is particularly hard, the present is difficult. Your present is hard to deal with and is distressing. And for a long time there, the news, and still now actually, the news is just nothing but bad news every day. Sitting down and watching an old film, even if it's a fantasy, because... A lot of these old films, as lovely as they are, you know, existed in a period where things were bad for a lot of people too. But it's a fantasy. It's nostalgia. It makes people feel good. It's like when people used to go to the cinema to watch films about very wealthy people during the Depression in the US. You know, there was a huge range of films that came out during the Depression where they show this very lavish, wealthy lifestyle, which, you know, most of the people in the US probably were not experiencing, but they wanted to be diverted and they wanted to live in a fantasy for a few hours. So I think nostalgia is definitely something that helps people through a difficult present.
Yeah. Yeah, because I think the example I always think of on that subject is a film you and I discussed a while back, Clara, Meet Me in St. Louis, because we talked, didn't we, about how that film, it's kind of this escapist fantasy, like you say, but it also allowed people of the time to maybe process some of their feelings about being dislocated and away from the people they love and all that during wartime. So I think that's very apt. And I think perhaps that allows us to segue towards, we talked about these films going up on iPlayer, and there's also been this recent controversy about, well, it's a broader story, but about HBO Max's decision, what they did with Gone with the Wind. So I wanted to touch on that. So HBO Max took Gone with the Wind down from their service temporarily with the aim of putting it back up with some contextual materials, which is what they've now done. So the film now has, we don't get HBO Max over here, I don't think, but it has a 4-minute introduction by Professor Jacqueline Stewart from the University of Chicago. And they've also made available an hour-long panel discussion about the film from last year. And obviously, this is part of a broader continuum. So the film's been regarded as problematic for a long time, of course. It was controversial even initially on release. But this occurred during the period after the death of George Floyd and the subsequent Black Lives Matter protests in a lot of countries. And we've seen other things, haven't we? In addition to Gone with the Wind, we've seen comparable decisions about a range of comedy shows in this country, such as Fawlty Towers, Little Britain, that have either been taken down from certain platforms or they've had individual episodes removed. For a variety of reasons. So I was just wondering what you guys think about this prospect, really, of some old films or TV shows being made somewhat less available, if temporarily. To stress, Gone with the Wind is still widely available, but you know what I mean. Kelechi, how about you?
For me, I have no problem with studios taking accountability for their content. And for HBO Max, which, to give a further clarification, we don't get it in the UK. All of the kind of HBO content is licensed through Sky Atlantic and their various other channels. So the HBO Max won't even come to the UK for like at least another 5 years, according to Sky. So Warner Brothers does has precedent for this. So they did, you know, the, in terms of taking content down or certainly releasing their content with added disclaimers and clarifications. And that was the Tom and Jerry cartoons. And Whoopi Goldberg was, you know, gave a short introduction into, you know, why, you know, we're releasing this unedited, but these are examples of racial stereotypes and things that we consider as problematic. So in terms of, I guess, as an educational point of view, which is, I think that's what Warner is doing, you know, I don't necessarily have a problem with that. In terms of specifics with Gone with the Wind, you know, it's a film that I've only seen twice, and I've only seen it as a kid. And I've have no personal love or affinity for it. So, and obviously that comes down to its representation of the Black experience, that, you know, it romanticizes the South, and it dehumanizes Black people by reinforcing an imagery that still has a legacy today. And that's obviously of subservience and subjugation. And for a lot of Black roles, that is seems to be the only one that's acceptable. So we're never allowed to see Black, you know, lives in any other context besides that. And then if you're talking about from a broader range, in terms of how the systemic racism and generational ties that it still has, especially for me as a kid who's watching, you know, something like that and realizing, hold on, that, you know, Black people are more than just slaves. I'm, you know, more than that. And you're keeping witnessing those kind of imagery. You know, we're still seeing the spiritual ancestors of those, of that legacy, you know, in context of like The Help. I know it's different. The film version is different from the book, but it's still there as a medium. And it's like, and Green Book is still out there. So these are films that are, you know, done from a white POV and based on white comfort. So they're films that I would, that I say eradicated the black experience as if racism is ended. So they're films that they don't have to deal with the repercussions, which for me, when I was growing up, was a completely disconnecting experience. And I know that, you, Carl, and Clara will never be able to walk in my shoes, but, you know, when it comes to, you know, systemic racism, when it comes to the covert racism as well, you know, certainly from my experiences, from my friends' experiences, and to the police brutality that you see, especially in light of George Floyd's murder, these are painful things that we've had to deal with. And whenever we say anything about it, it's very evidently clear that we're living in a country that is still in denial about it. So in the grand total of it, these are short-term gains, you know, in terms of this kind of conscious reflection, as in, you know, whether we're taking down content, whether we're hiding them in a vault, you know, but there, for me, there's still content that is, how would I say it? It's like putting a plaster on an open wound. So, you know, it's, and what's kind of happened as well in terms of the discourse, especially in regards to Black Lives Matter, is that it's now becoming, you know, the Black Lives Matter Now movement is now all about culture war. Like, we've just raged a culture war, and basically, you know, the people who are opposed to it are talking about, oh, you're erasing our history. We don't, you know, it deserves to be celebrated. We need some kind of memorial or statue to identify with our history. You know, I know this is a separate subject, but let me tell you something. I've learned more from the statues coming down than they were even up. So it's, like I said, these are short-term gains, but they're not addressing the actual institutions and the problems that have kept us in this situation where Black people are looked as second-class citizens, where they're looked as you know, we're an afterthought. We don't have a value. We don't have a say, you know, and especially in media where let's be honest, we get our education from. It's things that we are propelled to our comforts, our sense of place, and our belonging, our identity. You can imagine for me as a young Black girl growing up, you know, striking an identity with a lot of those media was very problematic because I never saw myself in there. And especially when you're seeing imagery, whether it's blackface, whether it's, you know, Black women being suffering in silence and subjugated to slavery, or Black men being demonized and criminalized. That was, you know, it felt like that was the only narrative that was at play. I was never able to see some of those things. And the most important thing with the Black Lives Matter is about equality. It's about redefining what, you know, exposing those barriers, and recognizing that these barriers have hampered people of color, especially the Black community, from progressing and seeing beyond the stereotypes, beyond the you know, stereotypes and trauma and anything else that we look upon as dismissive. So it's not, for me, it's about also how it goes forward. I know everything's going back and looking at and just hiding into the vault, which is, you know, it's not really about, for me, it's, you can do what you want, but it's what we do forward. So it's not just about, you know, I know this is a lot to unpack, but it's not just about just hiring Black people in the sake of, you know, in the sake of your workplace or your institutions. It's about making sure you dismantle the barriers so that the things that you were holding Black people back from having those opportunities are actually having those opportunities to be in the room. It's not just about seeing more Black people in front of the camera and on screen. It's also behind the camera. As, you know, Sandra Oh, who did a recent interview with Kerry Washington the other day, was talking about her experience on the Killing Eve set and talking about how, you know, she was the only Asian woman on set and the British industry is far behind when she's working with 75 white people on set, which is crazy. You know, so for me, again, to reiterate, it's about what we do forward. It's about the constant education. It's fine for Warner to do the education and putting up the disclaimers, but it also shows you, along with, you know, the comedy shows, like you mentioned, with like Fawlty Towers, Little Britain, and even, you know, things like The Simpsons and The Creators of Family Guy, they're saying we're not allowing white actors to voice Black characters anymore or any non-white characters. And even, you know, 30 Rock have now put some of their episodes which had blackface in it. You know, it shows you, as if we're thinking about media being a production line, if there's a lack of diversity in those high places, then it shows you that from script to screen and distribution, people were okay with that. That is highlighting of the institution of itself. That is the problem of it. Because trust me, if I was in a screening room and someone was doing a blackface, you bet your ass, I'd be saying something about it. Like, that would be it. But it just shows you that, there's a culpability and acceptability that went through those mindsets to get to that they thought was acceptable, and that's an ignorance on that side. And Gone with the Wind has been notoriously been problematic, but it just goes to show you that even as culturally today, we're still coming to terms with even some of the recent content that has come out that people thought was acceptable. So there's a lot of education, there's a lot of listening that needs to be done, because that's the most important thing for Black people, like for me, who may have mentioned these things, may have said these things, and people were equally dismissive and say, "Oh, it's in your head. Oh, that's not how it was meant to be." Is that, you know? And you know, we had to suck it up. But this is a time for that kind of reflection. This is the time for that kind of understanding, and it's not going to be solved by just hiding away. Yeah. You know, we have to prepare for those uncomfortable conversations so that the next content that comes out is not doing those kind of problematic things that have been notorious. And especially is something that in media where it is rampant. But yeah, that's what I was saying.
I think the basic approach HBO Max took with Gone with the Wind was a sound one. I don't see how people can reasonably object to additional context being provided. You know, I think films don't exist in a vacuum. So having a better grasp on the cultural issues about the things we watch seems like a good thing to me. And like what they've done, they haven't like gone in sense of the film. The film is still available for people to see as it has always been. I think it should be done more, this should be done more equitably. I think Gone with the Wind gets a lot of focus because it's so famous. It remains, if you adjust for inflation, the most commercially successful film of all time. But there are lots of other films we could point to that also contain elements that we see as problematic. So I'm behind HBO Max doing this, but I hope that having done this with Gone with the Wind, they don't just stop there. And I've watched the introduction they've tacked onto the film now. I'm not sure how it works on HBO Max. I'm assuming that when you press play, it starts with the introduction. I don't know if you can skip it or whatever.
I would assume it's attached to the film itself. So it would be something that they at the beginning of the film. So you won't be able to skip it anyway, unless it's a program command.
Okay. Well, it's a 4-minute piece anyway. And I think it covers the issues well in a short space of time, very accessibly. What do you think, Clara, about this issue?
Okay. So, yeah, I have a lot of thoughts too. I think that, first of all, I have no problem with them adding introduction to Gone with the Wind, adding some historical and cultural context to it. I've always liked Gone with the Wind as a film, although, and I'll admit, when I watched it as a child, I didn't necessarily get a lot of the racism because I have a very different experience to Kelechi growing up. But however, I, watching it as a teenager and then as an adult, especially after I learned about the transatlantic slave trade in school, it was definitely something that I saw in the film. I think that it's, like you said, it gets picked out more than other things because of the fact that it is such a famous film and it is about the South. And, you know, it was one of the films that, you know, I mean, it's very, very obviously using racial stereotypes in it. You can't like ignore that. It's there, right there for you to see. And because it's supposed to be like, you know, like Kelechi says, it's glamorizing the South and this life in the South that was built off the back of like slavery, you know, that's, you know, apparently dying, slowly dying. We're supposed to feel sad about that, but you're sort of like, well, you know, your wealth was built off the back of slaves, so maybe your society deserves to die. But one of the things that I think is interesting is this idea of erasing the past. There's been a lot of talk about that recently, and I guess this would fall into the context with films as well, is you can't really erase the past. The past also as well itself is written by a certain select group of people. Most of the past has been written by men, white men. So, you know, there are people like Harriet Tubman, you know, who are remembered in the US, but are not really known across the world internationally. Or, you know, I mean, a lot of black people or people of colour have been erased from history or forgotten. And so I would argue the version of the past that we're getting is a very constructed version that maybe isn't necessarily reality. But the past was bad. It was crap for a lot of people. Like, you know, even just 100 years ago, a majority of women in the UK didn't have the vote. So, like, you can't like erase it and make it seem better, you know. However, you don't have to necessarily champion the racial inequality of the past by, in, you know, sort of promoting a movie that shows racial stereotypes or just blatant racism. You don't have to champion slave traders by having statues of them in the center of your town. So I would agree that we should learn learn the lessons from the past while also looking at them in a more modern, looking at stuff in a more modern context. And one of the examples I'd say of this is that one of the women that I know on Facebook, she teaches in a university and she teaches about ancient Sparta. And Sparta was a society where the majority of the population were slaves. They were called helots. And she says every year her students they're starting to make different arguments about the helots. You know, like the helots were an economic resource. You know, they were migrant workers. They weren't migrant workers. They were enslaved on their own land. But, you know, like, you know, they were serfs, which is another way of basically saying land slaves. So basically calling them anything but slaves, you know, like unpaid labor. And she said that she felt this was like a trend amongst her students in America, possibly caused by a lot of the stuff that's coming from Trump and, you know, the sort of cultural zeitgeist, I suppose, of America at the moment, sort of looking at the slaves of the past as something other than, you know, enslaved human beings. And so I think that's interesting. I think, you know, people look at the past and they raise up these societies as models societies, right? But actually, for a lot of people, they weren't model societies. So it's not about erasing that. But the other thing I would say is there's also a difference between drama and comedy. Now, I'm not excusing like the League of Gentlemen or Fawlty Towers at all. But there's something in between, like a sort of sincere, well-meaning drama. Like, I think when they made The Help, they were genuinely trying to be sincere and well-meaning, which makes it so much worse. You know, it's like ignorance, like well-meaning ignorance, you know, which isn't an excuse at all. But there's something different between that, like the white savior kind of model of The Help, right? And then the mocking of stereotypes in The League of Gentlemen. Now, I've never been fond of The League of Gentlemen as this comedy show, really, because I find it a bit too creepy for my liking. But part of comedy has always pushed the boundaries too far at times. And part of comedy's ability to change things is by exposing the ridiculousness of stereotypes. So the racial stereotypes in these shows, I think part of it is like it can be funny because racial stereotypes are so stupid. Do you know what I mean? So it's like exposing something that's stupid and making it funny. I've always enjoyed Goodness Gracious Me, right?
Yeah.
And Goodness Gracious Me exposes like the racial stereotypes of Asians in the UK. The difference is it's made and written by Asians in the UK, right? By that community. The League of Gentlemen was written by white men. So them blacking up, you know, is more problematic, I think. If we had, you know, if you have a comedy show that's written by British, the black British community or the Afro-Caribbean community in Britain, sort of joking about racial stereotypes, then they're joking about their own demographic. You know, they're making, it's like almost like reflecting on their own culture and like sort of laughing at it. You're invited to laugh with them, not at them, which is a bit of a different situation.
Yeah.
I think stuff like Gone with the Wind and, you know, it's the past, so we have to acknowledge it, and I think we have to sort of put it in context and learn from it. But then what I want to see, what Kelechi was talking about, is like going forward, like just make better films. And the thing about, she was talking about Green Book, like I'm kind of surprised that Green Book even got made, you know, and it's about making better films going forward. And she, you know, talking about representation in film, it's not just about hiring, like, you know, black people, like Kelechi was saying, or hiring people of colour. I can't tell you how many films I see on a regular basis where anyone who's a black actor in it, specifically men, are doing something violent. Like even the Creed films, I know that people love them, but it's about a boxer who's violent, you know? And
its depiction is not necessarily endorsement though, is it?
Well, yeah, but I guess what I'm saying is that like one of the films I saw last year, it was If Beale Street Could Talk.
Yeah.
And it was like, I was really surprised. It's one of the first films I've seen with a genuine romance, like a romantic film about like love and the struggles of love between two African Americans. You know, it's not a drama where one of them is, you know, shooting at police or a drug dealer or living in abject poverty. And you know, you want to accurately represent the experience of African Americans. But as a white viewer, I'll tell you, all I'm seeing on screen on a regular basis is black men being violent, and those, I suppose, are the only roles that, you know, African-American male actors can get. But at the same time, it's also perpetrating a stereotype which has no basis in reality. It's criminalizing black men in America again and again and again in culture. So it's not just about Gone with the Wind. It's about, you had a chance to make a film about a black jazz musician and you made it more about his white driver, yeah, in Green Book then you made it about him. And I'm thinking, well, there was a black character who wasn't shooting people or fighting. He was a musician. Like you, La La Land, like you had the chance to put a black character in La La Land and you made him a sidekick to a white guy who was like gonna educate everyone on jazz. It just, I was like, make better films. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, stop making black people slaves in films and make them, you know, naturalists or scientists or writers. Or there's a huge number of African Americans in history who've really done amazing things, who've been inventors, you know, and we don't see films about them.
Yeah,
sorry.
No, yeah, that's absolutely true. And again, it just keeps reinforcing the stereotypes and almost the conditioning of those types. And then when we do see them, we're almost shocked and amazed that, you know, I recently read, I've been watching a show called I May Destroy, which is written and directed by Michaela Coe. And one film reviewer by Alison Pearson was somehow shocked and at that black people were human beings, which and also talked about, you know, you don't see how do I put this? She was talking about how their blackness was irrelevant. And for me, it's a shocking confession made by her in a sense that the blackness is part of the actual discourse. Because I don't know if you guys have seen it, but it's a show that deals with consent and rape. And they're very difficult and uncomfortable subjects. And, you know, Michaela Coe's coming in with very, you know, unapologetic and very strong depictions of it. And if we're so and by Alison Pearson's frame of mind, she's coming in with the standpoint that she'd never seen black people do other things besides being slaves. And the fact that by quoting it as being irrelevant is also another way of saying, well, I don't see color. And that becomes another part of that kind of conditioned dialogue that only eradicates our experience. Because when it comes to, you know, as you know, something like whether it's Me Too, whether it is the Black Lives Matter movement, those experiences, you know, they still don't have, you know, the black voices that are attached to them. And suddenly, you know, like something like Me Too, which was created by a black woman, but is elevated by a white crowd. And we tend to focus on the white voices on those experiences, but not the black ones, even though they are silent or made silent periodically. Mm-hmm. So it's these kind of conversations and these kind of nuances. It's not, you know, this podcast is not going to explain everything. And there's so many different nuances that there are many, as Clara says, you know, for me growing up, and this is something that we've, you know, myself and Clara have been talking about, you know, we're talking about things like in school and how our education was different. And for me as a black kid, if you're learning all about, you know, the slave, you know, the transatlantic slave trade, and it's a minuscule of the, which romanticizes it and talks about it as workers and talks about it as an economic value, but actually not putting two and two pieces together, where actually you're taking black men and women and children, you're kidnapping them and transporting them to work on your plantation fields and all those and those things. There's a lot of hurt and there's a lot of generational trauma that comes out of that. And when you don't hear enough about black stories and you don't hear about black achievements, when you don't hear about you know, things that we've accomplished, and you know, there are contributions to society, then for me growing up, you can easily feel alienated, like you somehow you don't belong, like you are not welcome or part of it, even though you've played a significant part in, you know, winning world wars or part of any other aspects of history. So it's all around us in a sense. And as is, and I'm trying to, you know, without trying to, you know, get too heavy, but it really pains me that when we still get these kind of narratives, but these are part of those uncomfortable stories that we have to face as a society, because we have to make better movies, we have to make better content, we have to have those content that is challenging, and really eradicate those ideals of where somehow black people are looked at as an afterthought. We are more than slaves. We are more than criminals. We are more than the sum that meets their parts. We are, you know, we are human beings. And it's become very easy within, whether it's our education process, whether it's the institutional systems that are in place within right now, and even the media that we consume, that it feels very much acceptable that that is the practice. Yeah. And that becomes it every single time, instead of actually paying attention to what it is. So what happens is that even something like the protest movement can even still be decriminalized. And they talk about the looting, and they talk about everything else besides the actual cause of that movement and the voices that are attached to that movement.
Also, I would say as well, like, in following on from that, like what you were saying, this is very particular for America. Like, you're talking about history, and I feel that America as a society really digests its history through film. So, you know, September 11th happens, and then a few years later they make a film, I think it was with Nicolas Cage, about a firefighter going into the World Trade Center. And I mean, that's a prime example. You could have replaced Nicolas Cage with a black actor. I mean, there are plenty of black people and black firefighters in New York.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, you know, you have a film about, I think it was called United 93, about the, you know, one of the planes that went down in the, you know, September 11th attacks. Like, they've had quite a lot of films over the years about the war in Iraq and the war in Afghanistan. And so, you know, this is the interesting thing. America digests its history through film and through popular culture. It's very, very big thing. And what we're seeing, though, is one type of history. We're not seeing the history, like I said, like, I mean, I guess Hidden Figures came out, and that was one example. Although, you know, obviously Kevin Costner's character had to be invented because they need a white savior in a movie like that.
Yep.
But, you know, I mean, there's an example of a period of history that just is not being publicized in the US. I mean, and, you know, there's just 12 Years a Slave, and I know, you know, but like African-American history in the US cannot just be summed down to, you know, summed up and just like whittled down to just people being slaves, you know? So I guess what I'm saying is, if you're going to digest your history through film and you're going to make, you know, films about disasters and big historical events and about politicians, and then you need to also make films about the history of people in your society who have either been forgotten, or have been overlooked, or have been purposely pushed into the carpet because you don't want to make history, want to make films about that kind of history, or because it makes the society feel collectively guilty. I think the thing about the US is it's a collectively guilty society, because most of the people who are African American in the US are direct descendants of slaves. They have this huge cultural trauma, which is that they had a flourishing slave trade that allowed the US to become economically wealthy, and which built a lot of what exists in the US today. So yes, you want to tell stories about the slave trade, but you also want to tell stories about all the African Americans who did other things in history that are not being told. Like, Hidden Figures is a prime example. We're always seeing films about astronauts in space, right? We know about Neil Armstrong, right? But how about the people who got them there? You know, the mathematicians, the scientists. And there's been more of that recently, but it's just not enough.
It's even worse when it comes to British history as well, because there's hardly anything there.
Let me just make a few broad points here, and then I'll throw back over to you guys for some final thoughts. But there's a few things there. I think in terms of America, I think there's a richer history of African-American cinema than is often recognised. I think there were filmmakers from the early part of the 20th century, like Oscar Michaud, for instance, who worked outside the mainstream, but he was making films populated as films of black actors. He himself was African-American. And I think there's not enough knowledge about such figures. And maybe his films are more difficult to see, for instance. But I think it's a shame when that gets kind of overlooked. That's one thing. Just on the issue of what Clara was talking about earlier, I mean, you mentioned things like The League of Gentlemen. It's very interesting to kind of try and unpack the individual examples, but I think you also need to recognize that there are different ways of reading things, and people's opinions will differ. So I think if we got 100 people here, for instance, and to talk about Gone with the Wind, and from all sorts of different backgrounds and walks of life or whatever, I think we'd be surprised at the variety of different opinions we would get back from that discussion. People don't always see things the same way. People might not agree with the best way to treat this film today, and I think we need to recognize that. In terms of these issues where things have been taken away or taken down, even if it's temporarily, I definitely understand the impetus behind that. I don't tend to agree with it, to be honest. I think that these things we're talking about, these films and series that we're talking about, they're important cultural artifacts in a variety of ways. And they serve as a mark of how things have changed, you know, how things were different even not that long ago, socially, industrially, in terms of what was acceptable. And I think people still should, I don't think they have to be glorified necessarily. I don't think they should necessarily even be promoted in some instances. But I'm not a fan of the idea of raising them, was the term I think you were using, Clara. And yeah, I think if that ever happens, that's not a good thing, in my opinion. What I think, and this might be too cynical, but I think with some of these sort of television companies and things who have done such acts, I think it's a gesture that becomes kind of an easy win. I think what they should actually be focusing on, it's like you both have said about going forward, they need to make sure they're treating people equally. They need to make sure they're giving opportunities to a range of diverse voices. To me, that's more significant than restricting access to things that are culturally significant, whether it's a film or a television program or whatever. So that, just a few broad points there. But yeah, any final thoughts, Kelechi?
I mean, I can't speak for The League of Gentlemen because I never really got into that show. But even something like Little Britain, you know, I think about it in a sense that I didn't like it even at the time. Yeah. I mean, I maybe laughed at a few jokes, but, you know, there were times where it just got painfully unfunny because of those cultural representations, especially at how they're useful, especially as Clara mentioned. You know, it's a different type of joke when it's done, written and directed by white people, and they're making fun of you as a race and heightening those stereotypes. So it's, as you said, it's not about, you know, glorification or promoting them. But even at the time, those voices still weren't listened to, as in, because the black community were very adamant, you know, even something like Bo Selecta, which, you know, we all sang the Christmas songs, we all did, you know, we all probably watched it on Channel 4, but it was still taking the mick out of Craig David and Mel B and portraying them in a very negative and disparaging way. So even at the time when these things were happening, it was easily dismissed. So it's, as we said before, to going forward, it's now about listening to those voices. And I guess the cynical for me is that in the moment that we're in right now, people want to be seen that they're doing things. They want to be, you know, yes, we're promising to donate money. We're promising to do this. We're promising to have an internal look and all those kind of things. For me, it's when the hashtags die down. For me, it's when, you know, it's not on the news cycles anymore. And, you know, and it's, whatever sense of normality is not going to be what we had before, but whatever new normal that we're clearly transitioning to, that's the time when we have to look at to see what these companies are actually doing, whether they're actually adhering to their own policies. Because if there's anything that is, I think I've certainly been aware of, is that if you're going to be posting up a black square talking about we stand with the Black Lives Matter movement, and standing with the black community and doing everything you can, and yet in the past you have not been standing up for black actors and black community. And I will point out to tweets like something like Star Wars, where they were saying, you know, when John Boyega gave a very impassioned speech talking about the real fears that comes with the black community, as in if we do say something, we get blacklisted, we can get sidelined, we might not even get another job. So we have to, in sense, suck it in the pain, or we just be dismissive. And Star Wars is coming out saying, yep, we stand behind you and recognize all your achievements, we're with you, John. But then, you know, I think back to, well, where was you when he was racially abused by a section of minority fans when they called him out for being a black stormtrooper? Where were you when his picture on an international poster was shrunken in comparison to all of his other co-stars? So if we're not pointing that out now, then they're going to get away with it next time. So for me, it's about holding accountability, and it's holding them to, like, if you are really serious about moving this conversation forward, and not just moving it forward because, like, oh, we've had enough now. Yeah, you know, it's in this trendy mood and now we're just going to go back to what we're doing. You're still part of the problem. So for me, it's about what that progression looks like. It's about, as I said before, it's not just hiring more black people because it's in the moment. It's about, what are you doing to dismantle those barriers that are affecting, you know, black voices being heard, from, you know, Black content being created, and any other people of color and other and the gender intersectionalities. What else are you doing to support those communities? Because if we're not tackling it now in this moment, then they're going to get away with it.
Okay. Clara, any final thoughts before we wrap up?
I mean, I would just like to see the next big blockbuster romantic comedy. I mean, I'd like to see it contain some Black actors, really. Like, I'd like to see some Black men being portrayed as romantic heroes, as opposed to the way they're being portrayed now. I'd like to see that. I'd also like to see some more films about Black people in history. Oh, and there are a lot of Black people in history. And I'd like to see... So, you know, I mean, you're going to make a film about... I don't know, like, I mean, they made one about Harriet Tubman recently. But, like, I'd like to see more than just that, though. You know, I mean... Pick a character. I'm sure that you, I mean, they fictionalize historical films all the time, so I'm sure you can add in some lines or script that the character, the person never said. But what you need is a really good scriptwriter, preferably somebody, you know, from a person of color, like as Kelechi was saying, someone that has like a diverse voice, someone that should be given the opportunity to write a script but hasn't been able to get there because of the barriers in place. And, you know, start producing films about history that. The history of people who've been forgotten. And I think you can do it. I think you can do it. And I also think the audience would accept it. I think the audience, I think this, sometimes these films aren't made because of racism and because of like systemic racism and racist institutions. But I think they're also not made because they think an audience won't want it. I think a white male audience will not want to go watch a film about a Black woman. And I think they're wrong. I think if you do it, I think the audience will watch what you give them. I think eventually, and I think if you just keep making these films, and you make more artistic and moral choices as opposed to commercial ones, then you might have, you know, more diversity in film. But I mean, the first step for me would be seeing a romantic comedy, just a normal romantic comedy that doesn't star two white actors, because I think we had enough of that, and I think. Portraying Black people as like, you know, sexy and loving and funny and exciting, as opposed to portraying them as either activists, victims, or violent offenders would be a start. So I know Spike Lee is doing stuff like that, but I also think that it should be done across the board in big mainstream comedies. And you are seeing more people of colour in mainstream films. There was that terrible film that, I mean, I say it's terrible because it's not to do with the people starring in it, but that came out at Christmas, I think.
Last
based
Christmas.
On a George Michael song. Last Christmas, yeah. But, and that was like a sort of mixed race couple. But I think what we need is something like Harry Met Sally that is ethnically diverse. We need a really exciting, big mainstream romantic comedy that stars people that aren't just white. Because everyone in When Harry Met Sally is white. Like every single person, I think. I don't think there's any people of colour. And it's set in New York, and New York is an incredibly diverse city. So it's just not a representative reality.
Yeah. I just follow on from that. I just want to see more Black heroes. Just period. Just no more white saviour complexes. Just more Black heroes. So that, you know, it feels like I'm identifying with them and a lot more. Because we carry a lot of weight. We carry a lot of, as in like... emotional weight, but from looking things through a diverse eyes, it resonates a lot more. So something like Queen and Slim, which is, you know, it is a political film, but it's also a very romantic film because of how Daniel Kaluuya and Jodie Taylor Smith, you know, talk about Black culture through them, as Queen, that's played by Jodie Taylor Smith, you know, she's talking it from a very professional legal sense, and Daniel Kaluuya is more or less like, you know, someone who's your typical struggling Black person. But throughout their movie, where they're dealing with very highly politicized events, it is also a road movie where they show each other breaking down those own barriers that we've, you know, as a Black community that we talk about, and maybe hold each other against. But in reality, we actually have a lot more in common than we actually realize. So if you do need the recommendation, please watch Queen and Slim, because that is a film that does have a lot of things that is very intrinsically Black, but also very depictive of what the Black experience is like. And it is a chance to see examples of beauty, and it's a chance of example to see even the politicization of how the world looks at Black people as well. So you can have both, and you can have Black heroes.
Okay, I think we could talk all day. I think that's a decent place to leave it. Just quickly before we go then, and thanks both for joining me today. Where can people find you online, Kalechi, beginning with you?
You can find me on Twitter at K.E. Henulo, and at my blog if you want to have a follow, which is at Geek Mind UK.
And how about you, Clara?
You can find me on Twitter at ClaraJeanMC. I also host a podcast about women and gender in film, television and fiction. And you can find that on Twitter at The Tales Podcast. It's called The Tales We Tell.
That's great. Thank you. On the Movie Palace, we'll be back on Independence Day. We'll be doing a crossover with the guys from the 250 podcast. And we'll be talking about White Heat, the gangster film with James Cagney. So that's our next episode. In the meantime, you can find us in all the usual places, on Twitter at Movie Palace Pod, also on Facebook and Instagram. But that's all for today, listeners. I hope you can join me next time when the curtain rises once again at the Movie Palace.
Elsewhere on We Made This. Without a mouse.
I've just done a little bit of a Google search, and car jousting is a thing in Germany.
All right.
Okay. Now, but weirdly though, it seems to have been from the mid-1980s. It wasn't, as far as I can see, it wasn't a thing until then. And I haven't seen anything come up about America. But I just thought, yeah, there has been such a thing as car jousting. So maybe Herbie Rides Again started a trend.
So in 1974, the people of Berlin were watching Herbie Rides Again and were just so entranced by this scene that they invented a whole new sport 6 years later.
The Time Is Now, a Millennium podcast.
But I think we may need to go back to a more innocent time. And maybe we should start talking about Peter Watts's Tash. Back in the
time. I love that we need to go back to a more innocent time. So let's talk about the baby in the cooler.
Well, maybe not the baby in the cooler just yet. Let's talk about the Tash. Joking aside.
It's much thicker, isn't it? It's actually, I really love that it's not a pencil mustache. Again, I'm going to take what little mirth we can from this and say I absolutely love that they're like, yep, he was a bit thicker on top, on his upper lip. You know what I mean?
Mild threat. And peril.
You can't, if you can see me now, all I've done is move my hands a lot. And I've just been pointing at the computer with a pen as if to emphasize my point.
I'm doing the same thing. Imagine, if you will, dear listener, that Emma and I are just opposite each other in a pub and just yelling at each other, pointing furiously at each other about shit that we've got to say.
Totally happen. I could see that happening. And not only that, she actively seeks my call out to be like, let's finish this.
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This podcast network.